Welcome to Your Homegrown Food. I'm your host, Wander Fox. This is a show about all things food. And on today's show, I am going to play a talk by Michael Pollan. Michael Pollan is an American author, journalist, activist, and professor of journalism at the University of California, Berkeley. He's written a ton of books that are all fabulous, including The Omnivore's Dilemma, The Botany of Desire, In Defense of Food, An Eater's Manifesto, and his newest book is called Food Rules, they are all great books. So he gave a talk at the Long Now Foundation, and I'm going to play it probably in three different sections because it's about an hour and a half long, and my show's only half an hour, so this week you'll hear the beginning of his talk, and I'll play the other two sections next week and the following week if I can fit them all in. Unless I have other cool things to talk about relating to food. But for now, let's listen to Michael Pollan, the beginning of his talk. And his talk is called Deep Agriculture.
Thanks a lot. Thanks for coming tonight. It really is a special honor to be invited into this community. And I'm very appreciative. I looked at the list of past speakers and many of my heroes. So it's a little bit surprising because I think people don't think of food and farming as about the future so much as the past, generally. Certainly that was the common view of agriculture in our society till very, very recently. It was kind of yesterday's news, you know, about as sexy as Green Acres or Beverly Hillbillies or the CBS primetime lineup up until a few years ago. But that's clearly changed. How we feed ourselves today goes right to the biggest questions of our time, and that's what I want to talk about. Farming's almost cool. Hardly a week goes by, and I'm not exaggerating, where I meet a software developer who's you know, taking his options and buying a farm. So what I'd like to do today, I'm going to talk for about 40, 45 minutes and then take your questions, and I look forward to hearing them. But I want to offer a kind of state of the movement address. Talk a little bit about where we are, because we're at this very interesting fulcrum moment, I think, of change around food, and where we need to go long term. Those of us who've been working for many years to reform the food system and the American way of eating, we suddenly find ourselves in a very odd and in some ways exciting but also uncomfortable new place. No longer holding a sign outside on the granite steps of the USDA or the Capitol, but inside with a seat at the table. Challenge now is to figure out what to say. I want to start out with a little quiz. I'm going to read you a quote, and you tell me or try to tell me which well-known critic of the American food system said this. Here's how it goes. Our entire agricultural system is built on cheap oil. As a consequence, our agriculture sector actually is contributing more greenhouse gases than our transportation sector. And in the meantime, it's creating monocultures that are vulnerable to national security threats, that are also now vulnerable to sky-high food prices or crashes in food prices, huge swings in commodity prices, and are partly responsible for the explosion in our health care costs because they're contributing to type 2 diabetes, stroke, and heart disease, obesity, all the things that are driving our huge explosion in health care costs. Any idea who said that? Yeah, President Obama said that. Isn't that kind of amazing? What that tells us is that we have a president, and we know he's a supreme dot connector, right, in many ways, but he's a very good dot connector in the food system, and that he has made the links between the way we grow our food and the healthcare crisis on the one hand and the energy and climate change crisis on the other. That's a very big connection to draw, and it has tremendous implications. So we have a president who understands these issues, we actually have a Secretary of Agriculture who appeared, Tom Vilsack, who appears to be charged with a mandate for reform. We don't know how far that's going to go. Although we do know his number two, a woman named Kathleen Merrigan, who's very closely identified with writing the organic rules and is a devoted reformer, is running the Department of Agriculture. That's kind of mind-blowing. And then, of course, we have Michelle Obama, who so far may be doing the most important thing of all, which is to say, talking about real food, planting a garden she took pains to tell the media was an organic garden. She didn't have to take that extra step. And, you know, it really pissed off the crop protection industry, as they currently like to call themselves. They wrote her a letter, actually. It was kind of, it was polite, but pointed about, you know, we really think you, by making this garden organic, you have cast aspersions on conventional food in our industry, and we really hope you will consider buying and using some of our, you know, wonderful crop protection products. Anyway, so all that is very exciting. It's given a huge boost, I think, to the movement and indeed to home gardening. If you've tried to buy garden seeds, you know, you go to your garden center and you will find, you know, kind of holes, missing teeth in that great wall of seed packets. But the question still remains, is there a mandate for real change? Is Obama prepared to use his considerable political capital on this issue? And do we have a path that will take us from where we are to where we want to be? Obama certainly did not run on a platform of reforming food and agriculture. Yet my argument tonight is that sooner or later, first term or more likely second term, he will find himself forced to deal with the food system. Because he will have a lot of trouble, he will discover, making significant progress on healthcare costs or climate change or energy independence without tackling the food system, because it is the shadow problem over all those three other problems. And the way we're feeding ourselves is at the heart of all three issues. Consider these a couple stats. The food system, as that quote indicated, and this news has reached Obama, but the food system as a whole, that's agriculture and food processing, uses more fossil fuel, about 20% of the total, and contributes more greenhouse gases, not just CO2, but methane and nitrous oxide from fertilizer, to the atmosphere than any other industry. Somewhere, depending on the studies, and none of them are reliable, between 17 and 34% of greenhouse gases traceable to the way we're eating. The industrialization of American agriculture over the past 50 years has transformed it from a system that used to produce 2 calories of food energy for every 1 calorie of fossil fuel energy. Because, you know, calories are just energy, right? You can have food calories, you can have fossil fuel calories. So 2 calories, you would get 2 calories of food for every calorie of fossil fuel you put into the system, to a system where today it takes 10 calories of fossil fuel energy to produce 1 calorie of food. That, you know, if you know, when we use this word unsustainable, which is a vexed, complicated word, often misused, I think that that's a pretty good case for an unsustainable industry, given what we know about the future of fossil fuel. And then there are many worse cases than that. Feedlot beef, your McDonald's hamburger, if it's fed from corn that's been fed from fossil fuel, is even worse. 55 calories of fossil fuel energy to bring 1 calorie of food to the table. So when we eat from the modern industrial food system, and this is the key point, we are eating oil and spewing greenhouse gas, which is kind of crazy when you recall that every calorie we eat is ultimately the product of photosynthesis. That is the only way to get food energy off of this planet, is sunlight feeding plants, plants turning that light, a couple simple minerals, and carbon dioxide into edible calories. It's the only way to do it. And if you're eating meat, you're eating the result of photosynthesis in the feed. And if you're eating fish, you're eating the result of photosynthesis in the algae at the bottom of that food chain. So it's the only way to do it. Food is the original solar technology. And there is, I think, enormous hope in that simple fact. Now, let's turn our attention briefly to the healthcare crisis. Since 1960, when I was a boy, spending on healthcare in this country has risen from 5% of national income to 18%. We won't be able to insure everyone in this country unless we get those costs under control. Now, there are many reasons for high healthcare costs, but one of the biggest, and perhaps the biggest if you listen to the CDC, is the cost of preventable chronic diseases linked to diet. Four of the top 10 killers are chronic diseases linked to diet. 2/3 of heart disease can be traced to diet. 40% of cancer can be traced to diet. Most of type 2 diabetes, most of obesity, obviously. CDC estimates that of the $2 trillion we're spending on healthcare today, $1.5 trillion, three-quarters, goes to treat preventable chronic disease. And this doesn't even include the cost of antibiotic-resistant diseases that are coming off of our feedlots or the effects of agricultural pollution. Now, is it just a coincidence that in these years that healthcare costs were soaring from 5% of national income to 18%, so it's between 17 and 18%, the percentage of our personal income we spent on food plummeted from 18% to 9.5%. So you see, as we have spent less on food, we have spent more on healthcare, which suggests that cheap food perhaps has some hidden costs. So that's the bad news. Our food system is broken. We probably can't afford to keep on eating this way. Cheap food has cost us dearly, and our agricultural policies are largely responsible. The intention of those policies, and I can't emphasize too much, the extent to which the food system we have is the result of the incentive system we created around food for our farmers, for our processors. The food system we have is not the result of the free market. It's not the result of nature. There is nothing inevitable about it. It's very evitable. And it is, that's a real word. And there is, so we have to pay attention to policy, and we will as we go through this. So that's the bad news. The good news is, though, that food is this original solar technology. If there's any part of the economy we should be able to re-solarize, you would think it is food. We are, as a society, I think, coming to a very important recognition, and that is that you cannot have a healthy population without a healthy diet. I think that's generally accepted. What's less well known, but equally important, and I think is dawning, is the idea that you cannot have a healthy diet without a healthy agriculture, that these two things are intimately linked, and there is no way to protect yourself merely by getting the right nutrients, eating the right things from a sick food chain. That really doesn't work. So the good news is that Americans increasingly sense that the system is broken. We have leaders who understand that it is broken. A movement for reform is building. And the market for alternative kinds of food, whether you're talking about organic or pasture-based or local, is booming. The even better news is this. The same policies that will reduce agriculture's contribution to climate change and the energy crisis will also dramatically improve public health. There is no issue of trade-offs. This is not a zero-sum. This is one of those lucky issues that is not zero-sum. We can make progress on all these fronts at once, make the system safer, more secure, more sustainable, and tastier, not only here in America, but in the developing world as well. What I think we won't be able to do again is make food as cheap as it has been, or something we can ever take for granted again. Now, food reform, you know, that's a big, chaotic subject, means a lot of different things to different people. And you've got lots of people in this movement working at in their own little fiefs. I mean, you've got people working on school lunch, very important work. You have people working on labeling. You have people working on building local food economies, bringing food to food deserts in the inner cities, getting the trans fats out of food, all these different kind of elements. And it is a little inchoate as a movement. And that's why when I use this term movement, some people are kind of surprised. But there's very little in the way of organizing ideas, big, simple ideas that will knit these people together. And that's what I want to talk about, the big picture. And the virtues of a big guiding idea is that it can help you judge all the smaller ideas, all the proposals, all the new technologies that come along. Are they moving you in the direction of your big idea or away from it? We have policies. We have personal policies, but we have public policies, so we don't have to rethink every question that comes up. So I want to lay out that big idea, a long-term framework for reform. And this is a process I began in an article you may have read, Farmer-in-Chief, in the New York Times last fall, at a time when I didn't know who the Farmer-in-Chief would be. A key feature of this idea is, as I said, it's not zero-sum. It does not pit rural farmers against urban eaters, or the interests of health and the environment against the interests of American farmers. Here's the core idea. We need to wean the American food system off its heavy 20th century diet of fossil fuels and put it back on a diet of contemporary sunshine. That's basically it. Easier said than done, of course. It will require changes at every link in the food chain that connects you to the soil that you're eating from, changes at the level of the farm, the marketplace, and the culture. And I want to walk through those three levels. But we do know this. The sun still shines very brightly, brighter than ever, in fact. If any part of the modern economy can be solarized, it should be food. Now, I want to just very briefly run through how we got here. This idea that we're eating fossil fuel is not immediately apparent. Basically, when we began industrializing agriculture, which is, begins before World War II but really takes off with World War II, what we were doing, another way to phrase that, is we were taking labor out of the farm and replacing it with fossil fuel and technology. So that all the big innovations, not all of them, but most of the big innovations in agriculture, such as ammonium nitrate fertilizer, pesticides, most of which are made from petroleum, were basically fossil fuel products. And they were very much the products of World War II. We took the munitions. Ammonium nitrate is bomb fuel, as we learned in Oklahoma City a few years ago. And we converted that to fertilizer. The same factories that were making bombs one day on a given day in 1947 began making fertilizer in great quantities. Vandana Shiva says that we are still eating the leftovers of World War II. And that's what she means. We're eating the result of that conversion of fertilizer and nerve gases, which became our pesticides. Those grew out of research into how to kill people. And we found that in tiny doses, they kill bugs pretty reliably. Now, the reason, what those technologies allow you to do is something that doesn't happen in nature very much, and that is monocultures. Very large fields of the same thing, which have certain advantages. A monoculture can be, in a very simple sense, an efficient technology. And these are technologies. One tractor, one pass can harvest a whole field of corn. One corn planter can plant 18 or 36 rows at the same time. So moving from diversity to this monoculture allowed you to greatly increase production. But you couldn't do it without these technologies. Because if you just had corn upon corn upon corn, you would deplete your soil. But ammonium nitrate fertilizer, a source of nitrogen, allowed you to replenish the soil from a bag. Monocultures are also supremely vulnerable to pests. You will build up a huge population of the pests of whatever, of your corn or your soy or whatever it is. So you can't have a monoculture without pesticides to defend them. And this worked really well. It still works really well from one measure. And we need to acknowledge the achievement of this system, which is that, put one way, you can walk into a fast food outlet and you can get yourself 2,000 or 3,000 calories of food, a day's worth, for less than the minimum wage for 1 hour. Now, if you think about it, in the long course of human history, where people have put so much time and effort into keeping themselves fed, this is an amazing achievement. It just happens to have come at a very high cost. So, but we should acknowledge that. And this has been our policy. We have rewarded farmers for planting monocultures. We only subsidize 5 crops. If you are a corn farmer, we'll give you money to grow corn and soy, but if you want to put in a row of broccoli, that land is permanently ineligible for subsidies. Okay? It's illegal for you to diversify your farm under our current agriculture policies. We wanted to encourage this. Earl Butz, the great 1970s era ag secretary, said, you know, plant fence row to fence row, get bigger, get out. And this was our goal. It was our goal because the public's interest was in having more cheap calories. And we need to remember when we started, I'm trying to be as sympathetic to this regime as I can, that, you know, early in the 20th century, the big public health problem was people were hungry. Even Kennedy, when he, you know, looked at poverty, found, great deal of rural hunger and urban hunger. So we asked our farmers to solve the great public health problem of that time, which was we need more cheap calories. And they did it. They did a brilliant job. The challenge today is to once again align the public interest with the work of farmers. Because I'm convinced that American farmers can do whatever we ask them to as a society. We just need to ask them for something a little different. Fossil fuel played other roles in the system. It allowed us to nationalize the system. We could move food from California with refrigerated trucks all the way to New York, and we began doing that. Fossil fuel pumped the water in the irrigation systems. Fossil fuel is what allows us today to have these, you know, really crazy supply chains. I mean, we are catching salmon sustainably. Native Americans are catching salmon sustainably in Alaska. It is then being flown to China to be filleted and then flown back to California to be eaten. So when you see that sustainable salmon at Whole Foods, you have to realize what hasn't been counted. California now feeds New York. That's an amazing idea. Iowa imports 90% of its food. This is the best soil in the world, does not feed Iowa, because they export raw material, corn and soy, gets turned into processed food, they buy it back. Iowa is a food desert, by and large. As Herman Daly pointed out, we import sugar cookies from Denmark, and we export sugar cookies to Denmark. And he said, you know, it might be a good idea to swap recipes instead. But this system will not go on indefinitely. Something very interesting happened last summer when fuel prices got as high as they got. The cost of shipping a box of broccoli from Salinas Valley to the Hunts Point Market in the Bronx went from $3 a box to $10 a box. Price of broccoli went through the roof in New York. And what happened when it hit that price was very interesting. You had companies like Tanmura and Antle and the big growers and packers in the Central Valley buying farmland in New England because they saw the writing on the wall. They saw that, you know, this is crazy. We're not going to be able to ship produce across the country indefinitely. We are going to have to figure out a way to grow food nearer to where people live. That they will be doing it and not New England's farmers is a tragedy, I think. But hopefully the New England farmers will get in on that deal. So I think we understand that we're in this little moment of cheap fossil fuel, and that whatever you think of the system, however much you like it, it depends on that fossil fuel and cannot survive it getting expensive again. So the challenge is then, how do you get this system off of oil, which is so deeply implicated? And by the way, it's most implicated in the fact that we have no farmers left. We only have 1 million full-time farmers in this country. 305 million people are being fed by 1 million. That's astounding. These are the most productive humans who have ever lived. One Iowa farmer feeds about 150 of his neighbors. And that has never been the case. And it probably can't continue because it all depends on cheap fossil fuel. So how do you get your system off of cheap fossil fuel? That's what I want to walk you through.
All right. Sorry to cut that off there. We are out of time for this show, Your Homegrown Food, for this week. If you would like to listen to the whole talk by Michael Pollan, you can find it on my Facebook page, Your Homegrown Food Show on Facebook, or it's also at the website fora.tv. There's more to... Oh, I suppose also at longnow.org, longnow.org, I believe. You can also find Michael Pollan's talk there if you'd like to hear the whole thing. If you don't get to look it up, then you can tune in to this show next week, next Wednesday at 11:30, and I'll play the next portion of the show. You can find out what else Michael Pollan has to say. So thank you so much for tuning in to Your Homegrown Food. I hope you enjoyed the beginning of Michael Pollan's talk there. He's a really dynamic, amazing speaker and has a lot of good things to say about food and our food system. I'm your host, Wander Fox, and you're tuned in to Free Radio Santa Cruz 101.1 and freakradio.org on the internet. And we are going to turn things over to Democracy Now! Thank you so much for listening, and have a great week.